surge, nurses were kind of asked to do like past their breaking point, like especially if you got COVID, like sometimes like the quarantine wasn't always as long as it was supposed to be, or like you could, if you were positive and didn't have symptoms, like you could work with other COVID patients if you took the right precautions. So I think they were just sometimes asked to work, like I said, past their breaking point and not really giving their body like a chance to just recoup. So I'm not surprised that they would have more like of the long haul symptoms. And I mean, maybe it's worsened by like their stress and fatigue and like anxiety from work. But it's definitely like changed healthcare. I feel like that's what I always talk about with my sister. She's a PA, and I'm always like, this is just like such a new world of like healthcare and treating patients and taking precautions. So it's been, yeah, it's been very interesting to be a student during this time for sure.
Just to be clear, this is Alyssa Cordell, not
Yeah,
Jones.
not Jones.
Did you say Jones?
Yes, I did. Sorry.
Okay.
It's really well. Let's go back to Jared for a minute. You know, if there's
Yes,
a
let's.
there if there's a lot if there's a lot of people like this, you know, from traditional medicine standpoint, what do we do to prevent his brain from shrinking?
Yes, I would really, yes. I need
the thing I tell everybody is the studies that help with brain health more than anything include 35 minutes of vigorous outdoor exercise at least 5 times a week. I don't know why not 37 or 40. It was done at 35 minutes. Apparently, you have to stop right then. But really, more than we have medications that help cut down on Alzheimer's and stuff. I'm going to tell you the truth. They don't really. Like, if the family doesn't know that the patient is taking it in studies, they can't identify if their parent was on a placebo or not. It's just these very specialized tests that show, okay, it slows it down enough for this test to possibly detect a difference, but the families wouldn't be able to tell the difference. At the end of the testing period, they say, was your mom or dad on it or not on it? And they cannot answer correctly. It's a very modest benefit. But something that is far more benefit and has been studied over and over is vigorous exercise and doing that on a regular basis. Even the ones that the cures that we thought of in the past were keeping your mind busy and active are probably helpful, but not as helpful in some of the newer studies as we'd hoped it'd be, like doing puzzles and stuff like that. I haven't heard about learning a language or learning to dance. Those used to be popular ones too. I do think those mind activities are good. You spend a lot of time around young people, and to be honest, I think that's good. The other big things is making sure that you are social. The less social you are, the more your brain atrophies. And so we are not. We're going to go on a tangent here for a second. So there's a recent show, I think it was on Hulu, about why people take recreational drugs. And there's the old rat study that we all heard about, where you put a rat in a cage by itself and you give him water, and you give him water with morphine. He will take the morphine water until and neglect himself to the point where he dies. This is not a plug for morphine, by the way. But interestingly, the rats in a cage that was full of other rats, and they socialize like rats like to, they didn't choose the morphine as much. Interaction and communication between one another from rats to humans is extremely important. And isolation is very detrimental to our brain health. And so being social, getting exercise is better than any medication I can give you.
And I'm going to add a plug for diet as well. An anti-inflammatory diet has also been shown to help prevent plaque from building up in your bloodstream that then causes strokes and heart attacks, and also inflammation, cancer, all of the kind of chronic diseases. Right now, I just, interesting kind of fact, COVID is the third leading cause of death in the United States behind heart disease and cancer. And really, diet and exercise is very helpful for all three of those leading causes of diseases. And again, it's that plant-based diet, as whole and organic as you can get, to avoid, you know, chemicals that we don't know how they affect us. And then clean foods. Basically, we've talked about this before, but if you kind of think of a hunter-gatherer diet, that is how we are biologically wired. And it's that type of exercise and that type of food intake that really does help us be our healthiest self. Specifically, there are no treatments that we know of at this point to, you know, that people can take to prevent long haulers or, you know, the brain shrinking and the heart inflammation. But one, just in case somebody has a question about this, delaying the vaccine 8 weeks for people that are younger can maybe help reduce some of the effects from both COVID and the vaccine. And also, I mean, there's little things that we're learning, but realistically, the big picture really boils down to kind of the how we take care of ourselves.
So just to clarify, what do you mean by delaying the vaccine by 8 weeks?
Oh, sorry. Right now, the mRNA vaccines, we give them three or four weeks apart. That was the original recommendation. And now for pediatric patients, younger patients up till age 64 that don't have any significant immune compromise, the CDC did come out with a new recommendation to wait 8 weeks in between the first and second dose of the mRNA vaccines.
What do you think that does that translate to adults?
That they saw potentially increased protective immunity from delaying. It allows your immune system to build up more memory from between the first and second dose. And then also for young patients, they're looking at the effect, if that improves some of the effects of both the virus and the vaccine, some of the negative side effects of the virus and vaccine. And I just heard that this morning, and that was new to me. So I wanted to address that in case anyone has questions about it.
So you're saying that I don't need to be following these studies of these, that they're developing a nasal spray for to prevent Alzheimer's, to shoot like omega-3 fatty acids like straight to your brain.
I have not heard that.
I have not heard that either, but actually very interestingly, along the lines of diet, a traditional hunter-gatherer diet, we get about equal omega-3s and omega-6s. Omega-3s are anti-inflammatory, mm-hmm. omega-6s are inflammatory. In the modern American diet, we get about 12 times more omega-6s than omega-3s. So, and then eating omega-3s through food sources that are natural to us have always, you know, more than the omega-3 pills, the different types of fish oil and flaxseed oil that you can take, food is always, hands down, the best way to get those omega-3s into your body. And the omega-3s come from the sources of vegetables, fruits, whole grains, seeds, nuts, and lean meats, especially salmon, which is great mm-hmm. for us here.
It is interesting. Every time one of these studies is done and finds that, this substance is really good for you, when we try to put it in capsule form, it never mm-hmm. improves anything. You've got to eat the whole food. I don't know why. I think we don't know about micronutrients. There's something there we're missing. And so don't run out and grab a bunch of omega-3s and be like, I'm safe now. Eat good foods.
So for a treatment protocol, though, we talked a little bit about the brain. Knowing that strokes and heart irregularities are commonplace, is there intervention or different type of testing that you're gonna see included in say a year from now? Is there something that Jared can do to go in and make sure that if something is amiss, you can intervene before, you know, it gets worse?
When I have patients that have symptoms following COVID, I am more likely to do an early EKG, refer them to the cardiologist for possible MRI or, you know, further testing to see if there's any more interventions that need to be done. But as far as, is there a test that someone can just follow up on if they're in a year, if they're completely asymptomatic, I haven't seen any recommendations for that.
I think the biggest complaint is cough, shortness of breath, and mental fogginess. Mm-hmm. And I've been doing some shooting from the hip, and I've had some success, but maybe it would have been successful if I'd done nothing. And that's the difficult part about doing unstudied things, is you're kind of making an educated guess on it, but it doesn't mean that what you're doing is actually fixing anything.
What? Was a good place to morph into the questions about vaccines. You talked a little bit about the under six vaccine. We have a lot of questions from people about the boosters when they're going to be available, what's going to be considered a booster in the future. And, you know, it appears to me now we're way past the point where the original shot and the booster would be effective, because our community seemed to get the vaccines pretty early in the game. And if you had a Johnson & Johnson, for instance, there was no vaccine available for a booster available for you. If you got one of the Moderna or Pfizer's and then got a booster pretty quickly, you're past the 8 months where it's supposed to be effective. Yet we still don't have an opening here, other than, from what I understand, you're saying if you're immunocompromised, it's available to you.
Yeah, that is correct. So the update, or the most recent, I guess, update from the CDC is that fourth dose is available if you're immunocompromised. And that's severely immunocompromised. That's not, you know, a lot of times we had people like, oh, I took a dose of steroids, and that's not what, that doesn't meet criteria. They are currently looking at the data for that booster to see who it's really going to affect, or, you know, increase their ability to resist further COVID infections. At this point, the data is not clear. Early studies from Israel and other studies haven't shown a significant increase from that fourth booster for the general population. And we are waiting for more information to make that recommendation. There is a lot of things that we don't necessarily look at, like memory B cells and parts of our immune system that we don't necessarily have a way to test, but do show that after that third dose, there's about a similar effectiveness, you know, a resistance to primarily severe COVID infections, hospitalizations, and death, that third dose seems to be extremely effective for, and they haven't as of now, there hasn't been a very clear indication that that fourth dose is much more effective than the third. There will likely be a recommendation for that fourth dose in the fall, and it may come with variant-specific targeting with the RNA sequencing of the spike protein or, you know, some of these new mutations, but that is all being researched at this point, and we don't have a clear answer yet.
Well, isn't it true that a significant amount of the people that just got Omicron had already been vaccinated, though?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it evaded vaccinations pretty well. And this, once again, it's going down to what we don't know. I say I haven't gotten COVID because I've been careful, but I really haven't been that careful. And when it really comes down to it, it may be going back to weird things, like might be my blood type. It might be that my bed faces to the northwest. I don't know what it is, but there may be genetic predispositions to COVID that we do know exist, especially severe COVID. But there may be other factors we just haven't figured out yet. And when it comes to the fourth vaccine, the biggest proponent of this, just to be clear, one of the biggest people shouting for the fourth one is one of the executives at Pfizer. So we have to be careful when we say who is asking for this fourth one, and is it beneficial. We've kind of focused on antibodies as being the measure of how immune you are to these things, and as Shanna's saying, that might not be a good measure of immunity. Yep, your antibodies go up and down after a vaccine, but is it making you safer in the end with getting another shot or not? And so I think we have to be careful what our measurement is. And if we're measuring antibodies, we're going to be tricked. But if we're measuring, as Shanna says, does this really help people? Then we get some better answers. And the data is not in for that. We are probably, I don't know that there's data on, even on severely immunocompromised patients. We're probably taking a guess at that it probably is helpful. And despite a lot of people's opinions, We see no significant harm to getting the vaccine.
And real quick, people that had been vaccinated, including the third booster dose, did get Omicron. People that had vaccine and prior infection were much less likely to get Omicron. And everybody who had some kind of protection were less likely to have severe symptoms from Omicron. So protection is still very important, and the vaccine has been extremely important. I think we'll never know for sure, but it seems to be effective in reducing the severity of the Omicron side effects or symptoms that we've had.
Well, what happened with, you know, the tailoring this mRNA vaccine to new variants? I mean, that was a big selling point when it first came out, is they were going to be able, within a week or two, come up with something that would redirect it for something else, and we'd be able to get a booster and protect ourselves from a variant.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. From the research I was reading, it's very interesting. They are investigating it, but so far in early trials where they've trialed it in small kind of pre-published studies in other apes and animals, the targeted vaccine for Omicron was not any more protective than the vaccine that we've been using. And of course, these studies are very small, and will they translate to humans? That's always, you know, the big next question, and they're working on that information now. But it may be that the vaccine that we have currently is the best one, but or it may be that there is another variant that has such significant spike mutations that this vaccine is completely not effective at all, and a new one needing to be targeted towards that will be the future booster that everybody gets, or like the annual flu shot that kind of changes each year.
And it may be that what it's grabbing onto, what we've talked about, the spike protein, just grabs on and spreads so quickly that the body doesn't even have a chance to react before you're infected, and then you have mild symptoms and fight it off. But it happens so quickly that the body can't react fast enough to actually prevent disease. And so, who knows? I mean, you look at these, the mutations and stuff, the antibodies still seem to be recognizing even the Omicron, because it does reduce disease severity, but it's not preventing disease. And that may be because, like we talked about, that the Omicron spike protein grabs onto the ACE2 receptor 3.5 times stronger, so it spreads quickly, easily, and fast.
With even with people who are vaxxed and boosted, and like me, you know, exhibited symptoms, and I'm pretty sure we probably talked about this last year too, we have like allergy season is coming upon us, and climate scientists are saying that, you know, there's going to be 200% more, there's 200% more like pollen in North America than there was like a decade ago. Allergy season is starting 15 to 20 days earlier in the spring, and it's lasting longer at the end of summer. As people are feeling these symptoms, they're vaxxed and boosted, whatever, should they still be getting tested just in case it's COVID? Or if they're used to their seasonal, I don't have seasonal allergies, but some of my kids do, and so it's like how vigilant do we need to be when with this?
So the home tests aren't as accurate, but when you do have symptoms, they are a little more accurate. So if you have a runny nose, headache from either allergies or, you know, COVID, those tests are a little bit more effective. I am strongly, and I'm very happy that the school district has freely distributed these tests, so that when you're at home wondering, what is this that I have, you can test yourself without the bother of having to come in. You look at the numbers of people being tested at the testing centers, and it has gone down drastically. And I don't know if it's because people just don't care anymore, which I totally understand, or if it is because there's more home tests available. I actually have a little bit of data on this. When we look at how many COVID tests we've done at Canna, it has gone from 2,700 in January down to 365 so far this month. So we are testing far fewer than we had in the past. What's your clinic like?
Yeah, we have definitely decreased testing. I don't have the exact data, but it's gone down a lot. And the numbers of positive tests are decreasing as well.
Yeah.
So do we even have a good sense of how much COVID exists in the community now?
The EOC is still reporting. I saw forget the number of active cases last night. No hospitalizations, although some of the nurses I work with in the hospital have said that they are still seeing COVID patients in the ER. It is still in our community. And yeah, I mean, we are at risk for it to increase. And just to kind of not minimize this, a million Americans have died from COVID in the last 2 years. And we are still having about 1,000 COVID deaths a day in the United States. And so, you know, we're hoping that this is going towards the pandemic being behind us, but at the same time, we are still dealing with it. In Alaska, there are still quite a number of hospitalized COVID patients, patients on ventilators. It's gone down significantly. I think it decreased by like 50% in the last week. But we, yeah, it's not, it's definitely not completely over yet. And we do need to kind of take that with the, what that means for us now. There is a, you know, a grain of cautiousness that we still continue to have.
Let's talk a little bit about vaccines for kids. Are we close?
Yeah, so we were hoping we'd have pediatric vaccines under for under age five early this year. The FDA is reviewing submissions from both Pfizer and Moderna, looking at the data for children under age five. And the two doses has not proved to be a significant benefit in preventing illness as was hoped. So they're looking at a third dose now, and that is actually showing really promising results as far as preventing kids from getting COVID in that younger age group. Also, you probably heard ages 5 to 11, the immune effectiveness from the vaccine wasn't as high as was hoped and wasn't as high as was seen in adult population. Couple of things. They receive a much smaller dose of the RNA, and that might be what's contributing to that decreased immune response. Also, the vaccines came out right before Omicron, which we're seeing, you know, decreased efficacy in all populations to that. So it's not clear yet why there was a decreased effectiveness, and we really need more data. Of course, the FDA, especially for children, does not make these decisions lightly and really wants to review the risk versus benefit. And so I think they're still looking at how much is this going to benefit the pediatric population. The hope is by fall, I mean, there is a significant, five times more children were hospitalized with Omicron than any other variants. So there is still a significant risk of COVID in our pediatric population. And I know a lot of parents, pediatricians, doctors are, we're really looking forward to having that protection available for younger children, but we also want it with clear data.
To follow up on something you started off with earlier about peeking into a grocery store without a mask on, you know, talk about masking relaxation. Is it individual practice? As your practice, most of the time you seem to be saying, I feel like I still need to wear a mask when I'm going into a store.
Yeah, most of the time I do. The first time I ever did it, I got busted by one of my patients. it's just one of those things. I do feel like I'm higher risk of being a carrier. I'm not trying to prevent me from getting disease. But let's be honest, I'm around COVID patients all the time. I feel like eventually I'm going to get it, and I need to protect people around me. So I do wear a mask because I'm higher risk. Do I care if other people around me wear a mask? I really don't. Being honest with you, it doesn't, you know. If you see me in the store and you see me wearing a mask and you're not, I'm not judging you. I really don't care. You'll probably see me there without a mask half the time, so it's okay. But is it effective? Yeah. I will continue to stick with masking is very effective. We saw that with the influenza numbers last year. We saw it that, you know, frankly, people like me who wore masks pretty religiously last year didn't get COVID. You can do all the right things and still get these diseases, but it does cut down on the numbers.
Yeah, I think if you're, again, kind of going back to who should still wear a mask, if you're immune compromised or if you're a caregiver for someone immune compromised or you're concerned at all, masking is still recommended by the state and the CDC. And in small circles, you know, where you have, you're all vaccinated or you're not necessarily going to be an at-risk member in the community, I think people really have relaxed those masking guidelines. And at this point, like, the, we're looking at the public health result of COVID in our community. It's very low right now. The risk is very low right now. And I think that's where kind of relaxing those guidelines comes from.
But if you really do want to protect yourself, you are going to need an N95.
Yes.
The mask you'll see me wearing in the grocery store does not protect me much at all. I just wear a simple surgical mask. Mm-hmm. I don't even think it meets the standard of a surgical mask. It's a mask. But if you want to protect yourself, do wear an N95. There are some that are better than others. Those of you who are immune compromised, I will once again endorse the type of N95 that protects you and has a valve, and you get to spray your germs over everyone else, because it's hard for a lot of our patients who are immune compromised to breathe. And so whatever you can do to protect yourself, but it's still be somewhat comfortable, I think that's important.
Yeah. And if you're symptomatic with a respiratory illness, I think it does help our community at this point to just wear that mask, protect others from COVID-like symptoms or COVID itself.
Or even the cold.
Yeah, even the cold. And
no kidding.
If people are wearing masks, students are wearing masks, I think it's really important to understand they might be going home to an elderly grandparent that's immune compromised. And so when people are wearing masks, I think, you know, that respect that as well. It's not that we all need to just get rid of our masks now. It is still, there are still a lot of important reasons to continue for certain populations.
Well, are we going to get closer to being like Japan, that masks become part of our regular culture all the time?
You're shaking your head no, Shanna. I don't think it's going to be quite as good as Japan. They're pretty good, man. When you get a cold over there, you wear a mask and nobody thinks twice. I think it's going to be a little more accepted here, though. Mm-hmm. I will say that.
Yeah, I doubt it will become, you know, everyone wears a mask all the time, but because like we've talked in the past, we're Americans and we want our freedom. I do agree, though, that we have gotten a lot of public health data from this 2 years of this pandemic, and they are very effective for preventing respiratory illness, and highly recommend them in those situations.
Mm-hmm. You got a final zinger?
A final zinger?
Yeah,
oh, gosh.
That's the humor time.
Now it's time for the jokes. No, not really. You know, I really couldn't find like a COVID myth buster of the month. You know, everything seems to have, like even said, you know, just it's kind of fallen away, and nobody's really talking about more of these kind of fringe things. I think there's still some things about the CDC seems to be like constantly updating or changing definitions and things, and so that sows a little distrust. But I mean, that's the nature of science and medicine, right?
Yeah, there is one thing, a public health PSA that I want to make sure I address. HRSA, the government funding for COVID, is going away and being reallocated to different resources in the United States. Mm. So they're no longer paying for uninsured COVID-related care that was free for everybody who was uninsured before. Insurance companies still pay for it, but just, you know, for people to know, if a clinic is saying it's no longer free, you have to pay an out-of-pocket expense. That has been rolled back, and that is, part of the Biden administration to kind of have a well-balanced approach to where are we putting our resources in America. I think, FYI for people.
The free COVID tests are coming to an end.
Get them now while they're still available. Yeah. Well, thanks. That's been an interesting discussion again. It's always a good chance to read up on what's happening in COVID medical news, and it's a nice opportunity to share your thoughts with the community again. So thanks very much for coming in. Nice to meet you, and hope you have a pleasant career here with us. And thanks for coming to Kodiak.
Yeah.
The overnight 8 inches of snow was actually pretty rare.
Okay. That's nice to know.
In March.
All right. Well, have a pleasant day. Thanks all for listening. This has been Mike and Jared and Dr. Theobald, Dr. Jones, and Cordell. Dr. Jones. Cordell, have a good day, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.